Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Owen Strand, an associate professor of Christian theology at the Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where he is also the director of the Center on Gospel and Culture. Professor Strand is also the president of the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, a research fellow at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, and a fellow over yonder at the Center for Pastor Theologians. When not teaching or directing all those organizations, he is writing and has authored and co-authored several books, including Awakening of the Evangelical Mind, An Intellectual History of the Neo-Evangelical Movement, Essential Evangelicalism, The Enduring Influence of Carl F. H. Henry, Design for Joy, How the Gospel Impacts Men and Women, Identity and Practice, The Pastor as Public Theologian, and The Colson Way, Loving Your Neighbor and Living with Faith in a Hostile World. That latter book on Chuck Colson will be the focus of our discussion today. Beyond books, Owen has also written for a variety of publications, including Trinity Journal, the Scottish Bulletin of Evangelical Theology, the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, First Things, The Atlantic, and Christianity Today, to name just a few. We will post links to his books at our website, www.researchonreligion.org, so get on over there and check it out. I should also note that today is the first time we've had an interview from inside an automobile. Now, it's not moving. He's not driving it. It's all good, but he is reaching us from inside a car. Owen, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you, Tony.
Okay, so what kind of car? Is it a Maserati?
It's a Beamer. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, okay.
I wish it was. I don't have State University money like you do. This is a Toyota Highlander.
Okay. Yeah, you got a bunch of kids, so it's gotta have a big thing to cart those kids around, I would guess. So
That's right.
From inside a Toyota Highlander. Today's broadcast is brought to you by Toyota Highlanders, I guess.
Only the finest for this podcast.
Exactly. I have to admit, one of the things I look at when I interview guests is just to take a look at their biography and find out what their background is. And I have to say that you have to be one of the busiest persons I've met on the show. You've like 7 or 8 books, and you're running a couple institutes and center. Where do you get all the energy for that?
Well, I guess I could say it's undiagnosed ADD, but I just have always had a lot of energy, honestly. And I've had some different opportunities come up to write and that sort of thing. You know, sometimes your book totals can sound a bit more grandiose than they might be, because I've edited some books, of course. I don't know. I love what I'm doing. I love writing. I've always loved writing. And so that kind of accounts for some of the book titles that you heard earlier. When I was growing up in coastal Maine, I'm guessing I'm one of the first folks you've had from coastal Maine.
It could be,
as opposed to non-coastal Maine, of course. I started writing for my local newspaper, the Down East Coastal Press. I did a writing seminar at the local small college, and the editor there said, hey, you should send us some stuff. This is when I was like 15 or 16.
Wow.
And for some strange reason, I did. And so I'm saying this because I guess I've always had in me the bug, the instinct to write, even from, you know, high school days. I remember writing a piece about Jesse Ventura, for example. Strange little episode there. But anyway, Undiagnosed ADD is what I would say, coupled with the Spirit of God. So that's a pretty propulsive combination, I guess.
Yeah, and that habit of just writing and writing and writing and then having the bug of loving to write is a really good thing for academics to have. And even though you mentioned that your book total might be more grandiose because you edited a few volumes, the people have to understand that editing a volume, even though you don't write every single chapter in there, still can be pretty difficult because it's like herding cats with a lot of different academics who exist on their own timeline.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's no easy thing to shepherd these kind of edited books to press. You're right. So you're not spending a lot of your time and energy on, you know, content creation. You're spending it on, please, begging, please send me the draft. I was reading about Churchill last night. He wasn't an academic, although a brilliant man. And he just had this compulsion at all times to be writing something. And I am no Churchill by any stretch of the imagination. But I don't know, Tony. I just connect with that. I can't help but write and read. It's my life. I love it. I'm sure you love those things as well. And I can't believe there's a profession, academia, or world of profession where, you know, you're supposed to do those things for a living. So I'm grateful to be in that realm.
Well, you are blessed with that thing. Sometimes for me, it's a slog to write, but you also do other things. And I want to ask you, you are on your way over to the Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where you're starting your new position as an associate professor, and you're also starting this new position as the director of the Center on Gospel and Culture. And I'm just interested in what that is. Do you get to sit around all day and talk to Bongo from U2 about theology?
I do. We're starting a new initiative. It's called the Harvest Wheat Campaign, and you'll be hearing all about it. We're going to make that cool again.
Yeah.
I'm excited to start working with the Center on Gospel and Culture. It's one of these centers that it's a pretty broad title, as you can see. And so I'm really looking forward to defining it. What I think we're going to set out to do from the outset is to be stimulating in terms of the theological content we provide, smashing into the culture, because that's really where I seem to keep finding myself in terms of my academic pursuits, bringing, hopefully, rich theology to bear on the pressing issues of the day. So I guess you're kind of combining both worlds there. You're deep in the ancient world, you know, you're reading the biblical text with Augustine, even as you're engaging the latest news about, you know, the presidential campaign or transgenderism at Target or something like this. I love being at that center of the collision between the ancient world and the very modern world. I enjoy that.
Yeah, and that's something that Jesus did way back when. He smashed up right against the culture, and all those great church fathers, they didn't mean for their books to be put on shelves and just looked at as a historical text. They were smashing up against culture too, so you got to bring them to bear.
That's exactly right. I mean, this there's something about Christianity that has always calibrated it for collision. You know, in a way that's somewhat unique when you think about a lot of global religions. Not, of course, that many religions haven't found themselves in all sorts of conflicts and challenges with the culture, but Christianity just seems to have a nose for it. Jesus, in his incarnation, according to the four Gospels, just kind of plunges in. You know, I mean, you read Mark's Gospel, for example, and it's very clear there's something that's being communicated. This guy isn't messing around. He's here to stand down those that he's against. And so, you know, you just recognize that there's a kind of posture there. And Christians, of course, can hold that posture helpfully or less helpfully. But we really are supposed to be at the intersection of the ancient and the hypermodern.
And that's one thing that Chuck Colson did. He smashed into political culture, into prison culture, and he's a collision of a lot of different aspects, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. But I have to ask that since you've written a lot about other historical figures like Jonathan Edwards and Carl Henry, how did you move into writing about Chuck Colson?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a little bit hard for me to remember what exactly pushed me in that direction. I remember reading Born Again during college, Colson's famous 1976 early autobiography, his account of being way up in the Nixon administration, and then it all crumbling down and him going to prison, of course, becoming a Christian very much in the midst of that. I remember being gripped by that story. I mean, it's hard, forget your worldview. It's hard not to be gripped by Born Again. It's just a powerful story and a fascinating story. You get a little bit of a bird's eye view into the Nixon administration from Colson's perspective. Of course, Nixon's hatchet man, as he was famously called. And so it's a gripping story in its own right. But then you consider that that wasn't the end for Chuck Colson. I mean, that's only really the beginning of his second chapter of public life for him. He goes into prison ministry and creates the world's largest prison ministry organization, Prison Fellowship. And then he goes on to very much stand at that place we were just talking about, sort of the epicenter of collision between secularism and Christianity, of course, calling for Christians to have a Christian worldview in the midst of a secular culture. And he does that in the 90s and 2000s, builds a huge radio show, Breakpoint, writes a ton of books, How Now Shall We Live Among Them. Anyway, all of that conspired to create interest in me. And so when he passed away in 2012, and I looked around and saw there's not a lot being written on this guy. As a historian, you're always just taking stock of who's being written about and who's not being written about, who deserves to be written about. And I just thought, you know, Colson deserves to be studied, in particular, by younger Christians who don't know his story. I think a lot of my peers have not necessarily chanced across Born Again. And so I wanted to tell his story again and then also inspire my generation, millennials, of Christians to stand up and be courageous in the public square. So that's really, those constellation of factors are what propelled me to try and write this book.
Now, you mentioned that he is a historical figure, and he has loomed large in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and he just passed away a few years ago. So for us older folks, it seems like he's really not history. He's just kind of part of our lives, and we don't consider ourselves history yet.
Mm-hmm.
But since he only did pass away a few years ago, did you have any opportunity to ever meet him? Do you have any personal connection to him?
You know, it's interesting. I did not. yet I have this strong interest in him. And lots of people around me, it kind of stinks, frankly, because lots of people around me did know him, did encounter him. I was kind of, you know, he's at the tail end of his career in the aughts, in the 2000s, at the same time that I'm graduating from college and then going to Washington, D.C., doing a church internship on Capitol Hill, then doing an internship for the Office of White House Liaison in the State Department, and then going to seminary, getting an MDiv, then going to another seminary in Chicago and getting a Ph.D., So suffice it to say, as you highlighted earlier in our conversation, I've always been a little bit busy, and I was busy, you know, sort of trying to get foundations theologically for ministry at the same time that things were really kind of building and then winding down for him. So all that to say, sadly, I never got to meet him. I interviewed a bunch of his key staff at Prison Fellowship in the Colson Center. And, you know, they mentioned, like, you know, you would have loved, once I got to know them a little bit, you would have loved meeting him. He loved talking to idealistic young people who had energy. And so, you know, I think I would have enjoyed talking with him, but did not have the privilege.
Yeah, so, I mean, that explains my next question I was going to ask is how you go about finding things about Colson. And I have to admit that even though you didn't get a chance to meet him directly, you get the opportunity to sift the stories of many other people. So you're somewhat of an outsider looking in, and that provides a very valuable story or perspective from the outside as well. So how did you go about this? You mentioned you interviewed a number of people who, you know, how many people, how long has this project been going on?
Yeah, it stretched on for a few years, and I interviewed, I don't know the exact figure, I don't know, 25, 30, more than 30, and really an interesting range, all the way from fellow churchgoers at First Baptist Church of Naples, Florida, where Colson was a longtime member. I just happened to meet somebody who used to sit in the pew right behind Colson. And so this figure had never been interviewed by anybody. The secular media or something didn't know about this guy I met. But he had a really interesting perspective on Colson that nobody'd ever heard. I mean, he could tell me what it was like to sit behind Chuck Colson in church, and I don't mean that in the kind of, you know, floating off the ground way. I mean, like, what was he like? And he just was very clear that Colson was down to earth and didn't carry himself with an air and always greeted those around him and always took notes during the sermon. Isn't that a fascinating little tidbit, by the way, this is Chuck Colson, an evangelical statesman, and yet he's taking notes all the way to the end of his life in sermons. I just was impressed by that. It shows that he's, you know, focused and tracking with the pastor trying to. So then, you know, I did interviews with a number of other subjects. I mean, I interviewed Eric Metaxas, for example. I interviewed Al Mohler. I interviewed Hugh Hewitt, all of whom knew Colson and interacted with him, some of whom had seen sparks fly in their interactions with Colson. I mean, he was such a big figure, honestly, Tony. It was a little intimidating because I could have interviewed, you know, 500 people. But I was able, I think, in the Colson way, to pull together a part of the Colson story that had not been told, because the last major work on him was published in 2003 by Jonathan Aitken, who's 2005. And so Aitken had not been able to cover the last 7 years of Colson's life, which were pretty eventful years. Manhattan Declaration and a number of other things were released in 2008 and beyond. And so I was able to tell the story of his death, for example, which has never been told in print. So because of that research, I think this book, The Colson Way, does make a contribution to our knowledge and understanding of Colson and his significance. And I loved doing the interviews. I loved hearing the stories and getting the data. Of course, reading his books. So that's part of the trail behind our book.
And one of the things I liked about the book as well is you did interview everyday people who had interactions with him, not just the high-end folks that you would meet in D.C. or the parlors of New York City. And, you know, those people have great observations. And the story that says, well, you know, here's the guy sitting a pew away from me and he's taking all these notes, and that's really interesting. And hey, that's the stuff that I think a lot of scholars overlook, but that is the stuff that is contained in your book here. So let's go ahead and dive right into Chuck Colson's life. And for those of our listeners who are not all that familiar with him, give us a brief bio of him from his, I don't know, I guess early background up through maybe the Watergate years to prison ministry.
Sure, and I appreciate your kind words there and fully agree about the little tidbits. I think that's really where the sauce is. So Colson is born in 1931 in Boston. He's a swamp Yankee. In other words, a lot of the upper-class folks had moved out of the area of Boston in which he lived, and so he's kind of lower class, lower middle class. He and that was a part of his formation and his character. He turns down Harvard in order to go to Brown University because of that background. So that's important for understanding his psychological temperament, because I think Colson always had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. I think it softens after his conversion to Christianity. But that's going to be a key part of him fitting into the Nixon White House, as many of us are aware. Nixon himself, of course, having a big chip on his shoulder and not fitting into high society Washington. Anyway, so Colson goes to Brown in Providence, Rhode Island, and it's there that he studies political philosophy and begins to be interested in ideas. He's a very typical American young man, the type that you teach and that I teach, and that, you know, up into his 20s, he's not super interested with big ideas, but then he gets a taste for it. You know, he has some good professors who turn him on to the clash of the intellectual life, and he loves it. He loves different philosophies, opposing views, and debating these, and so that forms him as well. He goes on to become a Marine in the era of Chesty Puller. He goes on to work in naval procurement, so he gets an understanding in Washington, D.C. of how to turn the levers of power, you know, how to get high-level contracts across the desk and these sorts of things. He works for U.S. Senator Leverett Saltonstall. There's a name for you.
Yeah, that's a great
one
name.
that's kind of an epic name. A Boston Brahmin senator, and helps see him reelected in the era of Kennedy in Massachusetts politics, which was an impressive accomplishment on Colson's part. He then ends up, long story short, working for Richard Nixon from 1969 to 73 as special counsel to Nixon. He's basically the guy, the fixer, the Michael Clayton of the Nixon administration. So if Nixon needed some, you know, a kind of a fake committee created against George McGovern, Colson was your guy, and he would have 300,000 flyers printed up, you know, by some strange-sounding organization that would snow the press. So that's what he does. He does a lot of other stuff as well. And by the way, Tony, he does a fraction of what is alleged in terms of Watergate and that sort of thing. He really and truly was not a mastermind.
Yeah, let's stop right there because I want to spend a little bit of time on the Nixon years, because the Nixon years are an interesting clash of both his conversion to Christianity and his feet in the Watergate affair, whether deeply or not so deeply, we can talk about in a second. But I have to ask you about this term that you used, swamp Yankee. I've never heard that. Since you're from coastal Maine, that must be a coastal Maine thing. What is a swamp Yankee?
Yeah, it's something that Colson brings out in his writing. You always watch how a person identifies themselves throughout life, especially a person as accomplished and with as varied a background as Colson. He's an Ivy League graduate, as I said, who could have had had Harvard on his resume, but he always referred to himself as a swamp Yankee. So in other words, he was a Yankee and he was a New Englander. And as a fellow New Englander, I know the fierceness of New England identity with which it's guarded. So I understand that. But he wasn't in the upper crust of Massachusetts society of Boston living. He grew up in a home where it was kind of tough to make ends meet. And so that was a part of his upbringing. He and his friends, I think, resented some of the Protestant establishment of Boston, and I'm sure they were trained to in small ways. And so that's a part of his formation. He also, interestingly, refers to himself throughout his life as a tough Marine. So he loved the Marine part of his bio as well. Colson is an interesting character because he really is high-flown as his life goes on, but he always brings out and plays up sort of the tougher aspects of his background. Again, the swamp Yankee thing, the Marine thing, that would connect more broadly with people. So I find that a remarkable part of his makeup that is, I think, a secret as to why he's so successful in prison ministry, because he's working with people who are very much from the same kind of circumstances or similar circumstances as he was from youth.
So that's one of the aspects that really resonates with me and Chuck Colson's life, is his swamp Yankee character. He's one of these guys that has walked the upper echelons of power, but yet he deals with folks who are kind of at the bottom barrel in prison. And it's that kind of character that really, early character formation that really allows him to do that. Let's now dig into a part of his life that is talked about quite a bit, and that's the Watergate affair. And it's a critical period in his life because it's not only the Watergate scandal that is going on, but it is also his conversion to Christianity. These two things are blending together. Let's go ahead and start and talk about the Watergate aspect of his life. And as you mentioned earlier, his role as the fixer might be somewhat exaggerated. So I'd like to hear your perspective on this. What role did he play in Watergate? And Yeah,
that's a great question. I don't have a ton on Watergate in the book, but I do cover his role in it, and I do cover that period. And what I would say is this. Colson is not the kind of Ehrlichman, Haldeman figure that he's sometimes portrayed to be, or kind of a minor or a junior Haldeman figure or something like this. In other words, he's not the mastermind, but he is mixed up in the Nixon administration. And probably the area where we most see his fingerprints in a less than ideal way is with Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers. He's the Assange before there was an Assange. And Colson goes after Ellsberg because of this. Nixon is predictably furious over Ellsberg doing that. And so Colson is the guy who plants stories in the press about Ellsberg, many of them true stories, by the way, and really plays hardball with Ellsberg. And Colson did this not just with this young man, but with a number of political opponents of the Nixon administration. Colson had learned these tactics in Massachusetts. So we're talking about the Swamp Yankee aspect a minute ago. Equally formative in Colson's life is Massachusetts hardball. I mean, he learned to play it. And so it'd be an interesting study for your listeners who are interested in these kind of figures, you know, to think about like a Bobby Kennedy and a Chuck Colson. Obviously not the same, you know, life story, same resolution to their lives or something like this, but both of those men, though on very different sides of the fence, understood to the full how to play tough and how to win more to the point in a very difficult climate. A lot of the things that Bobby Kennedy does, intimidating opponents, creating, you know, committees and these sorts of things, Chuck Colson learns to do in Boston as well, and both men have a tremendous amount of success. And so that's really what lands Colson the job in the White House. Nixon gives him an order early in Colson's time and says, break all the China with an expletive in the White House, but get this done by Monday. He tells him this on a Friday. And lo and behold, Colson pulls it off, and that's really where Colson earns his stripes with Nixon. I'm thinking of my terms here. I know what terms Nixon would have used to describe the types he liked. I'll say this. Nixon likes skull crackers, and that's the type of figure that Colson was. So that's what Colson does throughout his time in Nixon's administration from 69 to 73, and because of that, Colson ends up caught in the Watergate affairs. It's not clear to me that Colson masterminded Watergate. He certainly didn't. He did not want to firebomb the Brookings Institution. A lot of the things that the press seized about him and promoted as true were not true, and that's backed up by folks on all sides, John Dean and others. But Colson's mixed up in it, implicated in it, and so he ends up in prison in 1974.
And the prison, the reason he went to prison was obstruction of justice, and he spends about 7, 8, 9 months in prison?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. He has his lawyer craft a guilty plea because he realizes that he targeted Ellsberg in a too rough manner. And so he is not implicated in a major way with Watergate or the Nixon administration's corruption, but he is implicated formally in a minor way, and he didn't expect actually to have Judge Gessel, his judge, sentence him. He thought he was going to get off because really what he did was not anything major, but the judge decides that he's going to serve a 3-year term. Mm-hmm. So he's sentenced to a 3-year term in 1974, but he served 7 months of it, as you said. He's released in 1975, and of course we haven't yet talked about his conversion, but his conversion, you know, has happened just before he goes into prison, and that shapes both how he views prison and what he does once he gets out.
Yeah, and this is where I want to turn next. This becomes a very important part of Colson's life in his general outlook. One could say that somebody gets sent to prison and they have the jailhouse conversion. It might be legitimate, or it might be one of these things that say, hey, you know, let me out early for good time because I'm reading the Bible a lot. But it's interesting that his conversion experience is occurring before he goes to prison. It's occurring at the same time that all this Watergate mess is being stirred. So explain that. How does this happen, and how do, I mean, there's some interesting characters from the Raytheon Corporation that are in here as well. So how does this all occur?
Absolutely. And a key part of the Nixon psychology that we've been, the Colson psychology that we've been discussing, the Nixon psychology would take many radio shows, and Evan Thomas has talked about that helpfully in his recent book, Being Nixon. But a key part of Colson's psychology is that he was Nixon's toughest, most dogged defender throughout the Watergate controversy. I'm talking about fall of Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
So Colson goes to great lengths in 72 and 73 to defend Nixon. And you've got to remember that this administration had an insanely us-versus-them mentality. Whatever side you fall on politically, whether very conservative or liberal, everybody concedes that Nixon and his team cultivated that kind of mindset. And so Colson and others assumed that many of the things that the press were saying about Watergate were untrue, because Colson genuinely did not know about them, I think. That's my read on Colson. So again, he doggedly defends Nixon, but it turns out a lot of that was true, the taping and going after political opponents and the gap in the tapes and all these sorts of things that bring Nixon down collectively. And so that conspires to make Colson extremely disaffected and depressed in 1973, the summer of 1973. So he goes to visit Tom Phillips, who is the CEO of Raytheon, a major defense organization. And Phillips has become a Christian at a Billy Graham crusade at Madison Square Garden. And so Phillips shares his conversion story with Colson. Colson is kind of, I think, bemoaning what's happened to him, whining about the press targeting him. And Phillips, very directly, and Phillips was not some sort of, like, traveling evangelist figure. This was somewhat unusual for him. But he says, Chuck, if you guys had just played by the rules and done what you were supposed to do, God would have honored your work, but you didn't. You fell into dirty practices, and now your hands are guilty. And Phillips goes one step further and reads Colson a section from C.S. Lewis on pride, and Colson realizes that he is, in fact, proud, but not proud in a generic sense. And this is really important to get right, Tony. Colson sees himself all of a sudden as standing before the justice bar of God, and his conversion is not, as he presents it, is not some kind of just, you know, life improvement plan with a spiritual twist, you know, a desire to get things ironed out which weren't ironed out. He puts it very theocentrically, in very God-centered terms, that he has offended a holy God, and God has no reason to show kindness to him, but has chosen to send Christ to the cross to wash away his sin. And Colson sees that he's a sinner. And so in the summer of 1973, right after talking with Tom Phillips in Dover, Massachusetts, Colson leaves his house, is driving, and has to pull over by the side of the road, by his account, because he is so overcome by his own sin. And that is his conversion moment in a kind of C.S. Lewis way, interestingly. He takes a few weeks to kind of sort out his beliefs surrounding Jesus, specifically the divinity of Jesus, because it's something that he had not believed at any point prior in his life. He realizes he really does, you know, fully believe in the divinity of Jesus. And so again, it's that summer, just prior to him entering prison, where things shake down and Colson becomes a Christian.
And so this is interesting because Tom Phillips, the CEO of Raytheon, is part of this story, and you know, our outside perspective looking in, you would think, well, the CEO of Raytheon is some hard guy. You know, they're just counting their gold coins and playing war games with the world as if it was risk or something. But here, you know, here's another guy that, you know, upper echelons of power, and he's a Christian trying to help this guy here. And I mean, that's one of those stories you just don't think happens in Washington, D.C., right? Which is all the more interesting. And he does what's interesting, too. And I found this aspect interesting in your book, is that he doesn't hand him a Bible and says, here, open to the Gospel of Mark and let's start, you know, chapter 1, verse 1, but says, here's C.S. Lewis, here's Mere Christianity. And yeah. Colson then begins his study with a lot of these different theologians, and you document very well some of the influences of these various theologians or, you know, contemporary theological thinkers. Give us a flavor for some of his intellectual development.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I love documenting it because I love personally just tracing the influence of different figures across the span of church history and just history more broadly. So the first major figure to influence Colson in this period, right after he becomes a Christian, is R.C. Sproul. And R.C. Sproul is this tough, Pittsburgh-born theologian, kind of a similar background to Colson in terms of class. And so Sproul is famous for these lectures on the holiness of God, which key off of Martin Luther's conversion experience. And Sproul argues for a very God-centered understanding of all of life. So Colson understood his sin in what we call theocentric terms, you know, that it directly offended God himself. But he didn't really know that the whole Christian life, the whole endeavor, was supposed to be about the glory of God. And that's what Sproul helps him to see. And then in William Wilberforce, who Colson is introduced to by Michael Cromarty, who's now a VP at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in D.C., Cromarty is Colson's early research assistant, and he introduces him to this figure of Wilberforce. And that, I think, is really where the lights click on for Coulson in terms of who he's supposed to be post-presidential administration. Because he's searching. After his conversion and then after he's released from prison in 1975, he doesn't exactly know who he is. I mean, think about that. Anybody, any of us can sympathize with that kind of plight. You know, you're at the top of your game. You're at the peak of power. The Wall Street Journal, New York Times are putting you on the front page, and then all of a sudden it's gone. It's done. And you don't even know what you're supposed to be doing. In William Wilberforce, Chuck Colson discovers who he is, because Wilberforce is a very bright, gifted, socially adept person, but he's fundamentally an activist. And that is really key to understanding Colson post-conversion, because Colson is an activist driven by principle. And so he gets a model for how to do that in William Wilberforce. And he, of course, discovers his own cause. For Wilberforce, it's abolition. For Colson, it's going to be prison ministry. And I think that's a very key part of what takes place in those conversations with Cromarty after he's released from prison.
Any other folks that play a role in his theological formation?
Yes, there are a few. Francis Schaeffer is very important. Schaeffer is famous for popularizing what's sometimes called worldview thinking, the Christian worldview, so understanding all of life and all of thought as under the umbrella of Christianity, which, frankly, is a pretty key contribution. Schaeffer, of course, has taken some hits in academic circles and even in Christian academic circles in recent years, but I view him as a really important figure, frankly, in 20th century American Christianity and beyond American Christianity, because Schaeffer is one of these figures who says, no, you're not supposed to compartmentalize your faith. On Sunday mornings, you know, you go and you worship and you open up your heart and your mind and you think about the sermon, but then you go to your profession and you do it just like any other person, you know, Monday through Friday or whatever. Schaeffer wants to engage the Beatles. Schaeffer wants to engage Timothy Leary. Schaeffer wants to reach the counterculture. And so it's hard to underplay how significant that is in terms of influence in the evangelical movement, the post-war evangelical movement. And Colson sees in Schaeffer a thinking man's guide, because Colson is not going to become a scholar in formal terms. He's not going to enter the academy. He's not going to do a PhD. But he is a very, very bright man. He's got an Ivy League degree, and he wants to engage ideas. And so with Schaeffer, he gets a model for that. Also, Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper is a Dutch statesman at the turn of the 20th century, 19th to 20th century, who found newspapers and is kind of a journalistic figure, but is also the prime minister of the Netherlands, and is a pastor. I mean, he's really a fantastic figure. You read about him and you think somebody created him literarily, but they didn't. He's real. And so Colson starts to see with Kuyper how you can be a Christian and yet influence the political realm and other realms. And then finally, with Carl F. H. Henry, Colson discovers a Baptist model of a theologian, but also a theologian who is interested in social concerns. So Henry goes on to serve on the board of Prison Fellowship for 2 decades, working with Colson in the 90s, the 2000s, the 80s. So Henry gives Colson an understanding of how to be a Baptist, which is key. And he also helps him understand how it is that high-level theology can be put to work in everyday activism. Henry himself would stay up late in Pasadena when a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary, and he would go out and he would evangelize homeless people and drunks. And then he'd get up in the morning and teach a doctoral class on epistemology, and then over lunch, he'd write an article for Christianity Today on Karl Barth. So he's this remarkable figure, and he, too, has a major influence on Chuck Colson.
Now, here's a question that I want to ask, and it came up while reading your book. Is his pathway to Christianity, Colson's pathway to Christianity, is different than most people? I mean, the typical experience is as a kid, you're dragged out to Sunday school, you hear the story about Jonah being eaten by the whale, you sit there as a teenager in the pews and maybe join a youth group. Yeah, all that kind of stuff, right? And it's going to church every day, or I should say every Sunday, reading the Bible, and that's how you get your Christianity. This is not the pathway that Colson gets. In fact, he gets it through first C.S. Lewis. Now, he doesn't go right to the Bible. I mean, the Bible is important right there, but he gets it through these other figures. And on your reflection of looking at Colson's life and thinking more broadly, you think about Christianity and culture, that pathway to Christianity, what do you think about that? Did that have a different effect? Did it cement his Christianity more? Did it create a different type of perspective? What's your thoughts there?
Oh, I love that question so much. Really fun to turn around and think about in my mind. What I think I can most expediently say by way of reply is that Chuck Colson's conversion reflects the shape of post-war evangelicalism in America and even beyond, in that it's like you say, it's not a church itself that, you know, knocks on Colson's door or something. It's kind of a celebrity evangelical whose writings lead Colson to faith in Jesus Christ. And so, yes, that is an important thing to note. It reflects, and Colson's early years as a Christian reflect, the influence of the parachurch organization as well. When Colson initially is making his way through Washington as a young believer, he meets Doug Coe of the Fellowship, and a number of the folks who are connected to Doug Coe, and so that's another part of Colson's early formation, and that's going to play out in Colson's later Christian life, in that he believes in the local church. He's a member of the local church, faithful member, even as we were talking about moments ago. But he also has a bit of an impatience with, you know, just the local church itself. First Baptist sitting on the corner there, you know, Second Presbyterian right downtown. Colson believes very strongly throughout his life in the power of the parachurch and the power of his radio show, Breakpoint, to get things done, and in the reach of Prison Fellowship, in the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, which he founds in later years. And so you see in Chuck Colson some impatience with the traditional mode of evangelical engagement with the world, the local church, and with a real buy-in to the parachurch. And that's very much a late 20th century kind of mindset on the part of evangelicals. That's not to skew him. That's not to say that he didn't believe in the local church. He did. But he himself would admit and says in his book, The Body, for example, that he's not always the most patient man. And listen, investment in a local church, whatever your denomination, does require patience. You know, in theological terms, the local church is exciting. It's the instantiation of the kingdom of God on earth. But in actual everyday terms, it can be a little bit slow. It's slow activism. And so I think Colson felt that tension even from the time of his conversion to the time of his death, over that slowness, and always wanted to speed the pace up. That's a very Colsonian instinct.
So let's go into that Colsonian instinct and talk about his development of the Prison Fellowship, and also some of his later projects, such as Breakpoint Radio. This is a guy who's impatient. He wants to get out there and do things. How does he do it?
Well, That's a great question. He does it basically by putting it all on his own shoulders and just carrying the load and forming the vision as he makes his way through life. I mean, Chuck Colson is very much the kind of guy who decides midair that he wants to build a plane, if that analogy can hold up. So basically, he is released from prison in 75 and goes right back in. But he doesn't have a grand plan. He doesn't exactly know what he's going to do. He knows that he wants to go back to prisoners and tell them, very simply, that hope is found in Jesus Christ and only in Jesus Christ. But he doesn't know exactly what to do. The fellowship mentors him. Doug Coe encourages him to do speaking and writing for the fellowship in Washington, D.C. But Colson was always and ever his own man. So he wants to do his own thing and be affiliated with the fellowship and be friends with those folks. But he wants to do his own thing. So he writes Born Again few years later, he writes Life Sentence, which is a great read, by the way. Less read than Born Again, but really fun. And he teams up with a guy named Harold Hughes, who is basically not so much known today, but was a pretty important political figure in the 60s and 70s. At one point, very nearly a Democratic presidential candidate, governor of Iowa, senator from Iowa. And so Colson and Hughes have for years been vicious political opponents. They know each other in D.C. D.C. is a small town. They do not like each other. Hughes is part of the fellowship. Colson is brought into the fellowship, and the two of them are kind of staring at each other from a distance. Hughes especially is skeptical of Colson. Colson tells his story of conversion to the group, indicates that he doesn't really know what he's doing, which is remarkable coming from a man like Chuck Colson. And Hughes is cut to the heart, and long story short, Tony, the two of them basically start Prison Fellowship in 1976, which consists of bringing prisoners from around the country, really, to D.C. for spiritual instruction and what we would call early rehabilitation efforts. One of the most notable of these happens when Colson decides, and this is quintessential Colson as well, that he's going to take these prisoners to Capitol Hill, literally to senators' offices. So just think about this.
Yeah, they're not going to like that.
They're not going to like that, right? Yeah. You got this guy who has, just a few years earlier, I love the story of Chuck Colson for moments like this. He's just a few years earlier been totally publicly shamed and humiliated on Capitol Hill. He goes back to Capitol Hill. He brings a bunch of prisoners with him. He has them pray with senators on Capitol Hill. And get this, a senator is converted. Colson doesn't name who in Born Again, but apparently a genteel, probably, I don't know, Episcopalian Christian or something like this, who's only believed in Christianity in kind of formal terms, sees these prisoners who have, by the way, been converted, praying, and it has a deep impact upon him. And so that's one early example of Colson continuing to break China, having no mind for social barriers, and kind of making it up as he goes along.
Yeah, I love that aspect of him, because I think I see a little bit of me in that as well too. I don't have a plan for things, but you just rush and you say, well, you know, we'll fix it as we go along, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Was there any indication at any point in time who this senator was? Do we know now? Or is it still secret?
You know, I don't know, to be honest with you.
All right.
And I assume that we could probably know now, but I assume that Colson did not want the man known.
Well, we'll keep it secret then here on Research on Religion. So
I'll tell you offline, and then it can be like the secret tapes of Watergate.
Oh, excellent. All right. So that will remain confidential here, folks, and you'll have to do your own investigations in that regard. So tell us about, I mean, Prison Fellowship just is this, you know, Colson in a China shop, in the White House China shop, now in the Capitol Hill and prison China shop, and just saying, hey, let's just, you know, break some China and get things done. How does this thing grow, and where does it expand to?
Yeah, in the 80s, it just builds and builds. Now, I will say, Chuck Colson is Chuck Colson, so let's not make him too much of an underdog here. He is an underdog in a serious way, but he also has a Rolodex second to no one. So basically, he is making lots of connections as a young Christian, and everybody, Cromarty said this to me in my interview with him, everybody wanted to know Chuck because, yes, he was a disgraced political figure, but at the same time, I mean, this was Nixon's hatchet man, right? I mean, if Karl Rove suddenly fell out of favor, you know, with whoever, and became an evangelical Christian, you can bet, or some other religion, by the way, you can bet that everybody would want to meet him and invite him to their, you know, church or whatever and hear his story. He just, frankly, he's just got great stories to tell. So Colson had that kind of effect on folks. And in the 80s, that magnetic effect draws a lot of donors to Prison Fellowship, and it starts to become a really serious organization. He creates Justice Fellowship in 1983. That's the prison rehabilitation wing of Prison Fellowship, where he's working on different initiatives to actually help the conditions of prisoners, which I think is cool. The Colson Center debuts roughly in the late 80s, 1988, I think, and only, it changes over the years, but eventually births in the early 90s, Breakpoint, this radio show that, true to Colsonian form, is like a four-minute radio show every day, which even that format tells you something about him. He wanted to engage all the issues, but he didn't want to take 2 hours. He didn't want a nationally syndicated, you know, two-hour show or some three-hour show in drive time. So he does that. These are all part of prison fellowship. And from the outside, you can think, what exactly is prison fellowship? Well, here's the answer. It's whatever Chuck Colson wanted to do and add to his panoply of projects. By the 2000s, that means that Colson has continued to go into prison, as he's been doing now for decades, and simply share the gospel of Jesus Christ, the message that Christ is crucified and resurrected for our justification and salvation. So he's been doing that for years. That's really the core of Colson's life, his day-to-day activity, if people are wondering that. But he's also, again, recording Breakpoint. He's also spearheading initiatives toward the end of his life. For example, he's working on ending prison rape, which is always a joke in the public square, in the popular culture, but it's not a joke if you're in prison. And so he's working on those kind of things. The man, he's holding conferences on, you know, opposing secularism. Whatever Colson wanted to do, basically, Tony, he could do. And so that's kind of what prison fellowship is.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that just absolutely attracts me to his story, because a lot of times when somebody creates an institute or some type of organization, it starts out great. There's a lot of idealism that starts out, but then it becomes heavily bureaucratized and it becomes a thing unto itself that needs to feed itself. And this is a guy who, you know, as you say, he's impatient. He says, okay, we've done this. That's kind of working, but hey, let's now try this. Let's do a 4-minute radio show. Let's do this and that thing. And that it really makes it hard for the prison fellowship to become this ossified institution that, you know, loses sight of its original goals because it's always looking for different avenues to do things with.
Yeah, that's precisely right. And here's another little anecdote that tells us a ton that came across my desk just in a 2-minute iPhone recording of one of Colson's staff members. He would call the office at prison fellowship on Friday at 5:30.
In the evening,
right?
Yeah, everybody should be gone. In Washington, D.C., again, if you're, you know, on a Friday at 4:59 p.m., don't stand in front of any door that's about to open because you'll be trampled by everybody getting out of there so quick. Yeah, so
exactly. But this is the kind of temperament the man had. he just, like we're saying, he could not slow down. You know, even at the end of his life, he's creating the Manhattan Declaration, 2008, which is this key statement on pro-life convictions, on religious liberty, on the importance of traditional marriage, biblical marriage. So, I mean, when most of his peers are very happy to put their feet up in Palm Springs or, you know, some coastal location, Chuck Colson is trying to take the church and re-engage it in the great struggles of the day. So that's Chuck Colson. He could not quit. He could not stop. He could not slow down. And yeah, that's a really important part of who he was.
And so as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the interview, this book is one of the major engagements with Colson's life since that earlier book. I forgot the man's name. He wrote about 10, 15 years ago. What has happened since then? I mean, what's the final story as he kind of coasts into, I guess, the afterlife, to his place in heaven?
Yeah, what has happened specifically to Colson's projects, or
in the last, let's say, in the last several, you know, years, the aughts, and into, you know, his death in 2013.
Yeah, they continue. They continue apace. I mean, Breakpoint is going strong. Eric Metaxas and John Stone Street are the hosts of that, and you know, they have a very energetic and widely listened to program. Metaxas has kind of emerged as something of a Colsonian figure. Nobody has Colson's background, to be frank. Nobody in the evangelical movement. Nobody's trying to be Chuck Colson, and Metaxas is not and has said that. But in terms of a kind of very wide platform, ability to dexterously engage the culture. Metaxas has those traits that Coulson had, and so that needs to be said. Prison Fellowship is going strong under Jim Liske, the CEO, former pastor, who Coulson selected to be in that position. And so Liske has it continuing, very much continuing its ministry. Programs like Angel Tree continue, as UPS drives by me, continue to have a wide footprint in many American prisons. George W. Bush, when he was president, famously around Christmas time would visit some local churches and wrap some gifts that would be sent, as Angel Tree does, to the children of inmates as a kind of gentle gospel witness. So, man, I mean, I'm guessing that not all millennials know Chuck Colson's name, which is part of why I wrote The Coulson Way, but in terms of the major initiatives Coulson spearheaded and created in his life, they continue, which, frankly, is worth noting, irrespective of conviction or belief. I mean, many, many projects shutter, as we both know, you know, right after the impresario is gone. And that, frankly, is not true of the vast galaxy of Prison Fellowship.
Let me close off with one last question that I always love to ask my guests, and that's a reflection upon what they've learned through the entire process of researching their particular topic. And, you know, research is something that we just don't go find out some facts and tell people, here's what we have, and just lay it out for everybody. But it actually is something that changes the way that we look at the world. And I think the most successful research is stuff that makes us change our mind about things. In the writing of this book and in the researching of this book, what impacted you, and have you changed your mind on anything or your outlook on life?
I definitely have seen in fresh terms how central — this is going to be somewhat specific, but I think it's kind of important — how central prison is to the biblical narrative. You might not have been expecting that point, and I don't think a lot of readers or listeners would, but in other words, Coulson is known for going into prison, but prison, I think, is viewed by many of us simply as the launching pad, which took him where, in, you know, divine providence, he was supposed to be. But when you start thinking about prison in terms of the experience of many biblical figures, Old and New Testament, you realize this is really an important proving ground for Christian faith. Joseph is imprisoned. The Apostle Paul is in prison. Jesus Christ himself is in prison. Daniel is imprisoned in the Old Testament. I mean, we could name many others, and I actually have a little section in The Coulson Way where I talk about this. But that just shows me something about the Christian life, actually. And we're in the age of your best life now. The prosperity gospel has been hot in recent years. Joel Osteen and others promoting that. And so there's a very kind of biblical example I find in Coulson's life of really following a kind of Christ-like path to influence. In other words, not being crowned with laurels and glory as you know, your way to serve God, but actually as going to basically the worst place on earth, and that being your launching pad for Christian ministry. I see that in Coulson's life. I see that as a very counter-American, counter-intuitive kind of life program. Who among us is thinking, gee, I sure hope I can, you know, get a fulcrum in my life by way of prison? We're not thinking that. So Coulson is the classic American success story, right? But that's only the first part of his life. It's only really, I think, when he is humiliated and shamed that he actually finds what he was put on earth to do. He wasn't put here, you know, to run dirty press against the political opponents of a given president. He was put on earth to minister hope to hopeless people, and that's where he really comes alive. Bob Woodward, after Coulson's death, has a very interesting reflection on Coulson. Bob Woodward, of course, basically being figure with Carl Bernstein, who kind of ends Coulson's public life, right? At least the first chapter. So this is a guy you want to listen to. Woodward, not being an evangelical Christian, you know, I want to sit up and take notice of what Bob Woodward says in 2012. How does he view Chuck Colson? And he says, people have been skeptical over the years about Colson's conversion. But I look at Chuck Colson, and he's a god. This is his actual words. He's a god to people in the prison reform movement. And then he says words to the effect of, you can't argue with that. I just love that, Tony, because here's Woodward, who has every reason, and frankly, every opportunity, to say, yeah, he did some stuff. He took some time to be in prison, but, you know, the jury's out. That is not what Bob Woodward says. Bob Woodward, from his own worldview, very clearly believes that something profound happened to Chuck Colson. And I would submit that in our time, and this really opened my eyes, just studying this material, researching it, that's something that millennials are desperate for. That's something that our culture, our society, of all, you know, viewpoints and political positions is desperate for. Desperate for authenticity. We've seen one scandal after another in the church and the political realm. Divorce culture has become rampant. We've got children who are suffering and struggling, even as they are achievers in our schools. I mean, it feels like America has never been more prosperous, but never more hollowed out. And perhaps I sound like I'm soaring on the wings of idealism here, but when I look at Chuck Colson, who was definitely not a perfect person, who definitely had flaws, and had flaws as a Christian, flaws at the end of his life, worked too hard, could be a little rough with people, these and other things we could mention. But when I look at his example, I see a person who was hollowed out, but who, however you want to read his story, became full and became changed. And that's a narrative that many of us have been trained to be skeptical about and not trust. But I think I would just submit that it's worth considering that kind of example today, that maybe people really can change and grow, and maybe people can back up their convictions. And maybe young people don't have to watch as all of the people they look up to flame out. I think those are some of the things I would say. Can I say one more anecdote, too? I love this one about Colson, which kind of ties the knot with what I was just talking about. So Colson is called back to the White House in 2008. He's receiving the second highest civilian honor, the Presidential Citizens Medal. And in the ceremony, he receives a little pin. You know, denoting that he got this medal. And that is just that's a really cool moment in Colson's life that I discovered when I visited the headquarters of Prison Fellowship in Virginia, and there's a little glass case of some of his personal effects, and there was a little pin in it. And there's no reason really to note the pin, but I just asked the staffer next to me about the pin. And it turns out it was this medal that I just discussed. Well, it turns out as well that Colson wore that pin in his jacket, in his Brooks Brothers suit coat, for the rest of his days. And there, we have a little key into Colson's psyche as well, a final little key. And that is that at the end of his life, he comes back to the place of his undoing, and he's honored. And that was so moving to think about. But also, even as he's in that ceremony at the White House, he's recognizing that this is not the place that he wanted to be. This is the place that took him down. And so I picture him in that ceremony in 2008 as President Bush is pinning the medal on him, very much kind of having a life flashing before your eyes kind of moment, and seeing all the twists and turns of his life, and seeing how it was in being humiliated that he was lifted up.
A very interesting full circle type of story. And as you mentioned, a story that is critical for millennials today, but also for us older folks to kind of see that, you know, even in the darkest of times, you can just push your way through to the glory of God. And my guest today has been Owen Strawn. Owen is the author of The Colson Way. I highly recommend it. Owen, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.